This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. A good definition of collaboration in the mind of music director James Blatchley is when you look at the result of what you've accomplished and you say, there's no way I could have done that on my own. That's the spirit that the experiential orchestra is based upon. That orchestra, James Blatchley and violinist Curtis Stewart, recently collaborated on something they are incredibly excited about. So excited that Curtis says he wouldn't even call this a passion project because he would have done it no matter what. It's the world premiere recording of Julia Perry's Violin Concerto, and it's on a new release that's called American Counterpoints. That's what we're going to find out about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. Well, I'm going to start off by kind of having you each introduce yourself, and then we'll dig into the recording. So I'll start with you, James. For people who are, you know, just discovering who you are, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What's your path been to get you where you are today?
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to be with you. I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, so born and raised New York City kid, and I went to the Oberlin Conservatory and ended up studying composition, but I was very wide-ranging in what I was pursuing at Oberlin. It was very active and fruitful time for me. And then I went to Manus for a composition degree. My first master's degree was in composition, and then my second master's degree was in conducting. And I've been pursuing conducting for a better part of 20 years.
So, James, tell me a little bit about that. How did you come to the decision that conducting was a good path for you?
Very organically. One was by being extremely inspired by the work of Claudio Abbado at the Lucerne Festival, where I was attending, and several other very formative experiences with wonderful orchestras. But the other was, as a composer, I was working with wonderful musicians, collaborators, trusted colleagues, and coaching my own works as a composer. And at one point, I was coaching some songs, and one of my colleagues said, you know, you really should be a conductor. You know exactly what you want, and you're wonderful to work with. And I said, that's nonsense. I don't want to be a conductor at all. Soon enough, I realized that I actually had a passion, not just for advocating for my own work, but actually much more meaningfully for me, to advocate for other composers and to try to give their work as compelling a performance as I possibly can put together. There's something extremely rewarding about working on behalf of other people and having our work be about more than ourselves.
Ooh, I really like that. I want you to dig in a little bit more about that, because I'm guessing that has a lot to do with this new recording, American Counterpoints. Are they connected? And if so, tell me how.
Absolutely. I just find that music making is especially powerful when we know that it is for a deeper purpose, when it is hoping to provide something of value to the world. We had a wonderful experience, Experiential Orchestra, in our first commercial recording for the work of Dame Ethel Smyth, in seeing that recording really get recognized, not just on the merits of the recording itself, but to celebrate the important impact that Dame Ethel Smyth has had and the value of her music. And that experience certainly informed and actually led us to this recording, American Counterpoints, because we saw how effective a recording could be in advocating for a composer for the value of their works. When you hear a recording, it is almost impossible to differentiate between the quality of a recording and the quality of a piece of music, even for the composer themselves. So when you hear a recording that speaks beautifully for a piece, that is the best way to advocate for the quality of that piece and for having that piece get performed more frequently. And it's the intention of creating a recording that is compelling and exciting and truly committed that we put together American Counterpoints, Curtis and I, to advocate for the music of Julia Perry and Kohler's Chella Perkinson, who we believe to be two extremely important composers and who we hope will be performed more and more frequently on the basis of the quality and power of their music.
Curtis Stewart is with us as well. Curtis, you're the violinist. You've also done some composing, as we hear on this recording. Tell me about how you and James came to be working together.
I'm also an Upper West Side kid. I started out actually in Inwood, which is the neighborhood just south of the Bronx in Manhattan. And then my dad was on a waiting list for an apartment with a bunch of musicians in it. And it was like one of those types of Mitchell Lama rent-controlled. And he was on the waiting list for like 15 years and we finally moved to the Upper West Side. So I probably was there after, or I don't know if we were living in the Upper West Side at the same time. But James and I have been working together in one shape or form for the last 10-ish years. I've played in his ensemble, experiential, in various ways and shapes. One of my favorite experiences was doing the Rite of Spring dance party, where people were getting wild on the dance floor listening to Stravinsky. So I thought that was... I mean, I've always admired what EXO has done in terms of reshaping and just looking at concert experiences from different vantage points and literally changing the perspective within a concert hall for the audience member. And so when he called me to be the soloist on this Perry project, I was like, yes. He barely got the sentence out, and I was like, yes, let's do it. Personally, I was born in Helsinki, Finland. My mom was going to school at the Sibelius Academy there. She was a violinist and composer. And my dad is a jazz tuba player, and he was on tour. And they met in Finland, and I was born there. And then we moved to New York City when I was very young, like 3 months or 4 months old. Ended up going to, you know, Manus Prep, which is kind of funny that I'd never saw James there. But then LaGuardia Performing Arts High School, which is where my dad also taught. And then I ended up teaching there much later after going to the Eastman School of Music and studying math and music. I actually did not get into any of the grad schools of my choosing or auditioning after Eastman. And so I got a master's degree in teaching. So I started teaching at LaGuardia for 10 years, moved to Juilliard to help run the chamber music department there for 4 years. Now I'm on the chamber music faculty there, and I am the artistic director of the American Composers Orchestra. I'm trying to commission the next Julia Perry, or try to find her before, you know, while we still can. And so this project has just been a passion. I hate to say passion project because, you know, I think usually people associate that with something of less importance. But I mean passion project in that I would do this no matter what. Like, I think it's one of those things James and I have. I think that's what we have in common amongst many things, is it's like something we believe in. It's something that we just want to see happen. And we're just making it happen no matter what. It's kind of like leap before all the steps are there. So I'm really glad that it seems like people are catching us. We've spoken to people about it, and people have said, like, wow, this piece feels important. And, I hadn't thought of it that way. We just put our heart and soul into it. But it's not like people were reflecting on when the piece was written and the goings on socially at that time and between the 60s and 70s in America and what she may have been thinking. And so it's just amazing to be a part of this project.
I have so many questions just based on what you just said, Curtis, mm-hmm. and I'm going to backtrack slightly.
Yes, do it.
Your dad was a jazz tuba player, which that is not something we hear very often.
Yeah, he's like one of the ones. Like, the, you know, tuba players around the world reference him as an influence. He used to play with Dizzy Gillespie, Sonny Rollins. He's been in the big bands of McCoy Tyner, people like that. And I would hang out with him and this band Brass Fantasy with this guy, Lester Bowie, who was an amazing virtuoso trumpet player in a different kind of way. He made all these like squeaks and squawks that emulated vocalizing, but he would do that within the context of pop arrangements of like Sade or something. And so he was always mixing the avant-garde and the popular in that way. I used to play with Arthur Blythe, who's an amazing virtuoso saxophonist from the 80s and 90s. So I was around all these kind of crazy people, like on tour. I'd be going on tour with them. There's a picture of me and Dizzy Gillespie. He has his like cheeks blown out, and I'm like staring up at him at like 2 years old or something like that.
I got to see that. You got to share that picture. Oh my God.
Yeah, I got to see that too. I've been looking for it. I know it's there. That's going to be a Facebook post at some point.
Yeah. Well, when you post it, friend me. I'll share it out.
Will do.
That sounds amazing. You know, talking about brass instruments and how strange, like you had an amazing, rich, diverse, you know, experience musically in your childhood. Mine was like,
yes,
such a different direction,
right.
You know, just blocks apart. And I ended up living in Inwood. So kind of swapped, you know, you were born there and then I moved up there. But, you know, I had the first time I was in the New York Times, I was a 5 year old taking a picture of me playing a sackbut, you know, the medieval version of the trombone. And I just played it like one note or something, but the Times photographer was there. So there's this picture of me like right there in the art section, like trying to play a sackbut because wow. My parents were medieval and Renaissance specialists. And so, you know, my first musical language was akugan. And I thought that was a normal childhood. So I think just, you know, the way New York raised us both, and we're both, you know, children of this city, but, you know, I had some jazz experience, but it was later on. It's just amazing how rich the musical experiences that we both had, and it's, you know, to kind of come full circle together is really rewarding.
Well, it's kind of interesting that duality that we share is a similar duality of between Perry and Perkinson on this album. Mm. That, you know, Perkinson is really reframing a sense of modernism, abstract, contemporary chromatic harmony within the sense of the blues within, you know, he used to do arrangements of Marvin Gaye and worked with Max Roach. So he's coming from like a kind of stylistic gameplay within the world of composition. And Julia Perry is just like a, you know, the quintessential quote unquote serious composer, you know, very methodical. Every interval relationship is put into every combination that you can think of. And, you know, it's just so just incredibly, I don't want to say OCD, but whatever the positive word of OCD is.
Well, methodical or something.
Meticulous.
Sorry, that's good.
Yeah, determinedly methodical and meticulous thematically and intervallically. Yeah. So, and coming from a place of that, you know, I would say the more traditional religious church, which I think Renaissance music has kind of, you know, all the what type of music does Cantus Firmus? I'm spacing on the name. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The methodical, the process based, the commitment to compositional form and I would say, you know, methods is something we see in Julia Perry. And in some ways we associate that with very cerebral writing. But I think what you and I have discovered, or, you know, I've certainly felt in our performances of the violin concerto, and how you play it, how we interpret it together, is that it's actually very deeply felt, and there's an emotional component that I would say in my musical training and experience as well, is that sometimes the most, you know, almost intellectually rigorous compositions can also be the most deeply felt, and the one does not exclude the other. And, you know, we're performing the piece together in a month, right? The violin concerto, and we're pairing it with Brahms. And that to me is very purposeful, that, you know, to have this kind of association of integrity and compositional craft. And I think that's something that she definitely shares with Brahms and with many other composers. But there's something about her music that's both so intellectually rigorous, but also so emotionally profound.
So, Curtis, you were raised in this super interesting background. Your dad was immersed in jazz. You had a big taste of it early on, and yet you picked up the violin. How did the violin become your primary instrument?
My mom was a violinist and composer. I used to like watch her compose. She was of Greek ethnicity, but she grew up and was born in Poland. And she would hang out with the Roma people of Poland and learn about like Greek, you know, quote unquote, gypsy music. And then, you know, her mom was an opera singer in the Warsaw National Opera. So actually, one thing she said is she would always try to capture her mother's voice in the sound of her violin. You know, went to study at the Sibelius Academy. So she has that both classical and folk duality that many composers do, or at least many composers struggle with. And so I went to the instrument shop when I was 3. You know, I looked at some drums. I thought those were cool. I looked at some clarinets. I loved the little buttons on the clarinet. I was so fascinated. But then I remembered, you know, that little wooden box that my mom would pull out of the case every so often, you know, as a 3 or 4 year old. And I had to choose that one. And in fact, I even started studying clarinet in middle school. You know, they put you in band. They didn't have no clue that I played violin at all. So they put me in the band, and I got into Manus Prep for clarinet. And I was like, Mom, I can't believe I got into the school. I'm like, you know, I'm so happy. And she's like, that's great, honey, but you're playing violin. So it's both by choice and by love. I mean, I think I didn't really find my own. I didn't feel really good about my own violin, my voice on the violin, until after college, you know. And until recently, I feel like I've really owned a sense of freedom on the instrument. You know, I've been playing the thing for 35 years now, but yeah, we're here.
One of the things you also said, as somebody who's getting a chance to do a lot of teaching, and thank you for that, those kids must, or students, probably college kids too, but you know, what a blessing that they get to work with somebody with such a diverse background, both of you. And Curtis, you said, so we can look for the next Julia Perry. Why is that so important to you?
Well, I think about Julia Perry's story. I think about how many composers are just out and about in this world, and how few opportunities they have to get their music played, whether it's due to their personality, their situation, the people they're around. They don't have access to an orchestra or a chamber group or a pianist or a singer, whomever they can work with. And I think it's important, especially in the classical industry, for us to remain open and to find as many opportunities as possible to program and play current contemporary American music, and ways to frame it so it feels meaningful. There's just too many composers out there that we're just not serving. So I think it's not just about finding the next Julia Perry. I just happened to say it that way that time, but it's just there's so many composers out there. Like, you think about the number of people, violinists that graduate from a conservatory every year. You know, in a given class, there might be like 20 or 30 in every school in the country. There's probably a similar number, maybe in 5 to 10, from every school every year. And so those are all the composers that they're very bright-eyed, and they speak our current truths. They make music that is of the moment right now. Whether it's as deep, like if there's a patron that comes to see Brahms every year and they love Brahms, you know, that person will inevitably feel Brahms in that way because they have a relationship to Brahms. We must have a relationship with the now. If we don't have a relationship with the music of now, we'll never catch up. So I think that's what I meant by that.
Who would like to share Julia Perry's story and, you know, why she's so significant? Why do we need to know about her and her music?
We could both do this. I mean, Curtis and I have both spent many years exploring and getting to know Julia Perry through, you know, historical documents and whatever is available. I'll just start by saying, you know, my first encounter with Perry's story was, you know, before I heard any of her music, was Helen Walker Hill's incredible book, a trailblazing book, From Spirituals to Symphonies. And it has a superb chapter on Julia Perry, detailing not only her life story and trajectory, but also a very thorough list of works that were known of, you know, works that were published, works that were unpublished, works that had been written down and lost. So really tremendous scholarship. But Julia Perry was born in Lexington, Kentucky, and then moved as a young child to Akron, Ohio, where she was one of a family of five siblings. Her father was a prominent physician. Her mother was, musically got her into this very vibrant musical community in Akron, Ohio. And she had a lot of wonderful opportunities in Akron. She attended Westminster Choir College, where she was the pitch giver, which is essentially like the concertmaster of the chorus for two seasons. She was a very established conductor. She conducted her works throughout Europe. She studied with Nadia Boulanger. She won the Prix de Fontaine for her viola sonata, which is tragically lost at present. We still haven't been able to find that work that won the Prix de Fontaine. She had a piece, performed by the New York Philharmonic in 1965. Much of her kind of early career, she attended the Berkshire Music Center, which is now Tanglewood. She was accepted for 3 years, but the first year she couldn't attend because she didn't have any financial assistance. And so she attended the Berkshire Music Center for two seasons. She was a McDowell Colony Fellow and wrote several wonderful works there. And a lot of her success came in Europe. She studied with Luigi Della Piccola and spoke fluent Italian, spoke fluent French, ended up teaching both Italian and French at Florida A&M University. But she considered herself a composer. She didn't want to be seen as a teacher. And on her passport, she actually wrote Julia Perry, composer. It was really a part of her identity. And what we see in Julia Perry is both this meteoric rise as a young musician, as a young composer with really tremendous opportunities and tremendous accomplishments and celebration and recognition, and then a series of health concerns that left her at the end of her life destitute, living in her mother's house and continuing to compose despite really there being no interest in her music. And she was, writing letters to really anyone she could think of, asking for support in getting her music performed or published, or just for financial assistance. And so she really died destitute and alone with no prospects of her music being performed. But it was in the context of that tragic, end of her life, which is really one of the hardest things you can read about, is that part of her life story. The courage she showed in the face of that adversity is, to me, one of perhaps the greatest single example of creative courage I've ever heard of in my life. We give Beethoven a lot of credit for composing through his increasing deafness and for good reason. But to me, this story of continuing to compose when there's no prospects of her works being performed, and she had a series of strokes, she couldn't compose with her right hand anymore. She had to learn how to write out with her left hand, and her hand was so shaky that she couldn't write a note head. So she had to write the letter name of the note next to approximately where the note was. And in the face of those health issues and with no prospects, she continued to compose and continued to have no hesitation about the value of her work. In fact, she went back and revised the violin concerto in 1977, just 2 years before she died. And for Curtis and I, this is, gives us, it gives me shivers down my spine to think of how, she had a work she knew the value of, even though nobody else saw that value, even though there were no prospects of the work being performed in her lifetime. She knew that it was important to her to go back and revise the work, and for us to have the privilege of creating the world premiere recording of that piece is really one of the great privileges, certainly, of my career.
I was first introduced to Julia Perry's work by my colleague Janina Norpoth, who's an amazing violinist, composer, arranger, and we're in public quartet together, New Music Improvising String Quartet. And she brought Perry's Prelude in, and it's just this beautifully rich harmonically rich composition. It's such a tight little piece. It reminds me of Webern in that way, and it's not quite as harmonically dense or abstract as Webern, but it is quite rich and interesting. There's all these like question marks and answers and more question marks in a little two to three minute span. In fact, that's on this album. Roger Zahab did a great string orchestra arrangement of that piece. So we were working on that. We were trying to find a way to make that happen. And then we also did a string arrangement of Ye Who Seek the Truth. So that's Janina's arrangement that's on this album. As James was telling me, I learned about her story primarily through James and then also talking to Roger Zahab, who did a pretty heroic job of translating Julie Perry's like manuscript of the reorchestration into something that was legible, you know, something that we can use. So I think that is pretty tremendous. I mean, sometimes I hesitate to tell the story, but I'll say it. So the album that I just put out last year called Of Love is about my mom, who I was her caretaker for 4 years. You know, she was my kind of inspiration. She was a violinist, composer, very vivacious, very energetic, similar to Julia Perry in that way. She was constantly making music and making opportunities for herself. There weren't people pulling her up. It was just her making it, getting the funds, getting the grants, meeting the band members, connecting the venue to the local Greek restaurant and sponsorships and things like that, constantly making that happen. I mean, she was the one of the healthiest, most lively people I knew, more so than I was at that time. And she got stricken with brain cancer. And at the very beginning of that process, I was trying to help her compose to continue to be inspired. But she similarly lost access to her left hand and she couldn't really compose. She used to compose at the violin and she no longer could play. And it was, I could see that it was a massive strain on her sense of self-worth to try to push through that because it was just impossible for her. Even as I was trying to write with her, she'd be at the piano and just play kind of two notes over and over again. And that was our musical moment together. And every time that type of like focus on these two notes kind of reminded me of experiences trying to explore this Perry piece where there are a lot of repetitive moments. I'm not trying to say that my mom and Perry had a similar musical mind. It's just, I was projecting onto her piece in that way because I kind of needed to. And so it's hard for me not to treat this piece in a personal way that doing some form of justice to this work and really finding my way into it is an extension of the my caregiving for my mom in a way. It's like I can't not think that way, even if it's made up. And it's kind of ironic when we have this performance coming up in New York that will be on my mom's birthday, which is March 16th.
About, 9 days before the 100th anniversary of Julia Perry's birth.
Right.
Wow, that's such a powerful story. So this is the world premiere recording of her violin concerto. And let's talk about what we hear in this work because they're not very long movements. And I think, seven movements? Is that what I remember? It's a continuous work. The movements are not separate. So tell me a little bit about this work and how it flows and what it feels like to play it and what are we hearing? What were her intentions with this work?
Yeah, there are 17 kind of mini sections that are just delineated by tempo shifts. And actually, that part is very difficult. James and I have gone back and forth many times on just like, how do we make these little shifts happen? That's the most fun part of interpreting her work, I think. But they're all defined. The main theme is a major third moving to a major seventh. That's a tritone away. And that's stated very clearly at the beginning. There's a massive cadenza, solo violin cadenza at the start that states all the themes in about a minute or two's time that the rest of the work is totally ingeniously reworked around those themes in every way, shape, or form, both emotionally and, I guess, cognitively as a composer and from a composer's point of view. So she's just I see her like she's got these things she's just wrestling with and she cannot let go of. And she's trying to find resolution in something that just absolutely cannot resolve. That's my interpretation. And especially going from this very bright open major third to that major seventh, which for today's standards, actually a major seventh is not that dissonant. I mean, you hear them all the time in jazz and in pop music. But those two intervals right back to back from each other is jarring, and it keeps repeating, so it becomes regular and something to expect and to get used to and comfortable with, but it's never quite comfortable. And I see the whole piece is kind of wrestling with that internal discomfort that's produced by those two intervals.
Yeah, and just kind of adding to that, when Curtis and I were first exploring the piece, we were just talking and marveling at the ways that, you know, that major third in some ways can represent the early part of Julia Perry's career in a poetic way. And then the yearning, unresolved major seventh, at least in the way that I understand the work, the way that Curtis and I kind of poetically describe the work, that accurately reflects the latter part of her career, this unresolved kind of hollow sound. But it's the ways that she, in some ways a theme in Variations, you know, a way that she extrapolates so much music from just those two intervals is truly genius.
And there's also a larger interval in play. Every repetition of material moves by fifth up, which is kind of reverse, you know, in terms of, you know, tonal. Usually everything moves either by fourth up or fifth down in terms of resolution. So it's almost like all the themes are being developed backwards in a way, harmonically, in a weird kind of way. Theme happens throughout in every variation. Everything is moving by fifths, and then backwards again. Like the literal notes are, it shall state a variation, and then that variation moves totally backwards. Every pitch is almost every pitch is exactly backwards. And so for me as an interpreter, it's really hard to figure out exactly how to. It's almost like Bach. You don't want to be too ornate with your phrasing, because then you remove just the pure intervallic content that's in there. But then there feels like every note has a deep meaning because of that consistency. There's a section where I'm playing really fast stuff for a really long time. And it just keeps going for like a minute. It's really hard. I mean, violin-wise, it's just like... silly. It's just like, thank you, Julia. I'm now a better violinist because of you. I appreciate you.
She was a violinist too. You know, she was a great violinist herself. So, track two, I would say, is a great, you know, for the kind of poetic quality.
Is that the slower melody? Yeah. So that part's interesting too, because I can't remember if that moves by fifths all the time, but it definitely has the interval content of the third kind of embedded in all these little other half steps. And the seventh is very rhapsodic. There's a triplet. Becomes rhapsodic as opposed to pain.
This was a place that you brought particular kind of emotional quality to, that lyrical kind of theme, and the way that her orchestration is also so exquisite around that. You know, there's a kind of fluidity of how the winds support and envelop that intervallic content that Curtis is describing in the violin, that really matches also kind of where it's placed on the instrument, the particular color of that timbre of the instrument, and the way Curtis plays it. But it's really an envelopment almost, orchestrationally, of that sound.
It's almost like the orchestra is like echoing various pitches that I pull out. And so it's like, it's a great conversation. Yeah. So it's you can tell that she's like taking this intervallic material and really putting it through the emotional ringer, not just the compositional ringer of, you know, backwards, forwards, retrograde, you know, inverted, all that, but it's emotionally charged. And she uses register very clearly in the violin part. You know, it really feels like various singers are singing, like you've got the tenor part here and then the soprano part here, and I have to find ways of both finding one line through all of that, as well as being very clear that, okay, here is a new character as it jumps up an octave and a half just for this two beats. Jumping right back down, and then, you know, double stops everywhere. So,
when this is the world premiere recording, what does that mean? Does that mean you had no point of reference? You're just looking at the score and starting from scratch in your interpretation? Or are there other places where you could hear what other people had done with this work?
I'll just say it's not the world. We didn't give the world premiere performance. The world premiere performance of the piece was by Roger Zahab and University of Pittsburgh Orchestra in 2022. But it was, you know, shortly after that performance that, you know, the work is held by Carl Fisher and Theodore Presser was the rental agent, and they found a letter. That's where they found these edits that Julia Perry had made, you know, revisions to the orchestration primarily, you know, from 1977. So that was discovered kind of after Roger had created this performance edition and had performed the piece. But that was the only point of reference. And Curtis and I really explored the piece almost, like it was a blank slate. And that experience of really responsibility, I would say, of encountering a work of this, you know, this quality and historic importance, and to know that, you know, the first time people hear the work is through our performance of it, it's a great responsibility and privilege, but it means that we have to find a way to be as convincing as possible, because we do believe this work should enter the repertoire and should be performed frequently around the world. And so hopefully this performance gets other people interested in the work such that it's carried forward, you know, for generations to come.
James, I do want to ask you about this, the experiential orchestra. Tell me about the mission of this group, which you founded, and how long you've been together.
Yeah, the experiential orchestra is really an outgrowth of a collaborative process of working with close colleagues and friends who I deeply admire and respect and appreciate. And we have these friendships that are kind of born out through musical ideas and wild notions that we then make into reality. And the idea behind experiential orchestra is to design concerts around audience experience and to find a way for music to be a full body experience and a place where the audience can engage with the music and be swept up, but also that treats the audience with a tremendous amount of respect. You know, we invite and empower listeners with our concerts. So the goal is for people, whether they are frequent concert goers, you know, the New York concert goers who are, you know, been going to concerts for 40 years and are in some ways quite jaded. We want to reach them in the same way that we reach quite a few people who are hearing orchestras and you know, classical music for the first time. We find that our approach is really effective in being very inviting, welcoming, but also opening up new ways of listening. So some of the programs we've dreamt up in really collaborative ways, you know, surrounding the audience with 36 oboes and bassoons playing orchestrations of, you know, Lully and Rameau, you know, the oboe bands of Louis XIV and the medieval Sham and the Macedonian Zurla all celebrating double reeds. You know, that was something dreamt up with Brad Balliet, to, you know, this amazing program that Curtis and I co-created. And the experience of collaboration is so rich when you're working with a colleague that, you know, I think that Curtis is one of the great prophets of our time, and to have the chance to work with him closely and to dream up a program together is just such a joy. I was talking about collaboration with the League of American Orchestras, and I think a good definition of collaboration in my mind is when you look at the result of what you've accomplished and you say, there's no way I could have done that on my own. That's when you know you've had an effective collaboration. And that's the spirit that Experiential Orchestra is based upon.
I echo exactly what James said, which is the sense of collaboration. I certainly couldn't have done this without James. I didn't even have the idea without him, you know. And once we went back and forth with the program, it was really cool what would developed. Not just the program itself, but just how it was presented. We had these ideas about, for the concert, the first thing that happens is I come out stomping to, I come out from behind the audience and do this kind of stomp strut with a Louisiana blues strut, a cakewalk. Also a really difficult piece by Coleridge Taylor Perkinson. So, and I'm like kind of playing and I'm getting to know people in the audience and I'm kind of looking at people and moving around with them. And then the second piece, there's no orchestra on stage and the strings are in the round behind the audience. And James is standing there with me in the front. So it's just he and I, and I'm playing an arrangement of Deep River by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who is Coleridge Taylor Perkins's namesake. And there's like moments for a call and response that Hamilton Berry did this great arrangement of Maud Powell's arrangement, of Samuel Coleridge Taylor's arrangement of Deep River. So it's an arrangement of an arrangement of an arrangement. Any case, we're up in front and the strings are behind the audience and there's stomp clapping and singing. So we get the audience to immediately feel enveloped in the sound. And then we had this whole thing where we were having the audience sing the two intervals of Julia Perry's concerto, just so they can like feel those intervals inside and around themselves. And all these ideas just kind of emerged naturally. We just from talking about what we valued about Perry's work and what we valued about Coleridge Taylor Perkinson's work. I guess one valuable thing about a collaboration for me is that it just feels, or one rare thing is that it feels very fluid. And I think that's what James is able to do. And he pulls out the most and the best from a collaborator in that I have to be like, James, I don't even know if I can do all this stuff that we're dreaming up. Like, you know, normally collaborators are like, okay, what do we do next? What is the next step? I don't know. But we had to truly limit ourselves quite a bit with this project because we were just, it was like a fountain of ideas between the two of us.
Yeah, it was a big experience for everybody involved. And that was just the concert. And then from the concert, we got to the end of the concert and we said, this is what we have to record. So it was very organic to lead from one to the next.
Is called American Counterpoints, with music director James Blatchley leading the Experiential Orchestra along with violinist Curtis Stewart. Thanks to Valerie Kaler. She's our producer of new classical tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.